also share those doubts. So first of all, in the very beginning, I wrote the Lagrangian mechanical force for free and meals as a bunch of terms, and then at the very end, there was a kinetic term for a field C, and there was a term proportional to some zeta times VA mu squared. And Bruno was asking, what is this C and what is this zeta? And this, when you do a path integral over a gauge theory, over an unabelian gauge theory, you are summing over configurations of the fields, and you don't want to sum over configurations which differ by gauge transformation. Physically, they are the same. So what you do when you have a gauge theory, you need to introduce a way to sum only over inequivalent configurations. And this is done by inserting some fields which are Fadev, Popov, Ghost, and gauge fixing terms. Have you heard about them? Okay, so these are Fadev, Popov, Ghost, and gauge fixing terms. Good. Another question that he had, let me emphasize again, it was very important for our model to be integrable that the output of the perturbative computation was that relative coefficient between the identity and the permutation was a factor of -2. And let me recall why this happens. This happens because there is this very important vertex for the scalars, which is trace of commutator of the scalar square. And so there are two possible, when I expand that trace square, either I have phi I phi j phi I phi j, or I have phi I square phi j square. And this one, where the fields alternate, this configuration plus the rotation, plus the rotation, plus the rotation, all of them I can use to build the permutation, and therefore I get a factor of -4, because there is a minus. Whereas this one, if I want to see which graphs contribute to the trace, only this one, or rotated by 180 degrees, so I only get a factor of +2. And also, the Hamiltonian in the SU2 sector has SU2 symmetry because it commutes with the total spin operator, which is something that you can check explicitly and which is obvious once you write the Hamiltonian in terms of the SU2 invariant like you did in the tutorial. Also, when I say conserved charges, I mean quantum conserved charges and not classical conserved charges. And when I wrote the Young-Baxter relation, you remember I said at that point, we use here the permutation because this was a spin up and this guy was a spin down, this was a spin up, this was a spin down. So it's clear that here I need to use the permutation, but here I said my mistake that I should use the identity. But if I have a spin down and a spin down, and I want them to be spin down and spin down, I can either use the identity or the permutation. Both give the same thing. So there is an extra term which I missed there when I just wrote that only the identity contributed at that point. Okay. So, any questions about other things of the lecture? Otherwise, let's continue what we started yesterday. No? Okay. Yeah? Yes? Someone said something?
Why do these coefficients make an integral? I understand how you get them, and that's fine.
This was something that we saw yesterday, that when we were constructing this family of integrable Hamiltonians from this R matrix, the relative coefficient of the R matrix was fixed when I imposed that the R matrix obeys Young-Baxter.
Yes.
And from that R matrix, the Hamiltonian which followed was that with those precise coefficients.
Of course, with the m's, yeah.
Right, because of this when this m is equal to 6. So I was just answering your doubts. Okay?
Very good. So,
now, when we took the log of these equations, we saw that we had uj plus I over 2, uj minus I over 2. This was equal to a sum of k not equal to j, 1 over I, log uj minus uk plus I, uj minus uk minus I, and then there was plus some 2 pi mj. And I explained that we wanted to consider a classical limit where there are lots of particles and their momentum is very small, some long wavelength approximation, in which case we define the variable zj, which was uj over l, because uj scales like l, and in terms of this variable, this equation here became 1 over zj minus, I put that on the side, sum over k not equal to j, of 1 over zj minus zk, with the 1 over l here, is equal to 2 pi nj. And there was an electrostatic picture for this equation here, which means that the picture that we have for this Zs is that the Zs distribute themselves into cuts in the complex plane, into some lines in the complex plane, where all these particles which go to the same line in the complex plane, they share the property that they have the same MJ. And these ones which go to another support, they have another MJ. Then we introduce, in order to treat this in a continuum limit, we introduce the function, which was 1 over L sum j equal 1 over m, 1 over z minus gj. This was what I call the resolvent of z, a function g of z. And then there was some controversy about this sign. And I think, by the way, that when I made the exercise for today, I was not careful enough about this sign. So today I changed in the tutorial. I had a small sentence in the very beginning for you to be careful with signs. I tried to fix them, but it could be that there are still some signs. Okay, so P of z was given by this expression. And then the claim was that instead of solving the split equations, they were equivalent to what is called the Riemann-Hilbert problem, which is a problem in mathematics where we want to find a function knowing its discontinuities. And this Riemann-Hilbert problem was the following. We had the function p slash, which meant that when you have a cut in the complex plane, we will see why I'm always calling it cut instead of line. And I have the function here, p plus, the function on the other side, and p plus p minus is what I call p slash. And the statement was that p slash equal to 2 pi n when z belongs to one of these contours, c, was equivalent to this split equation. Why is that? Because, well, first let me write this as 1 over L integral rho of w over z minus w minus 1 over 2z. And then the statement was that when I take the average, I put 1 over z plus I0, 1 over z minus I0, and we saw some identity such that this integral becomes principal part integral, principal value integral, which means that I stop before the point, and this is precisely this sum over k not equal to j. If I am at some point k here, I want to stop a bit away from this point. I don't want to sum over the same point, otherwise it's divergent. Okay? So this was equivalent to bit equations. This is something important. I need to satisfy this equation when I will find my function. Then, if I knew this function, I could compute it close to z equals 0. What can I do with this function? I can compute it close to z equals 0, and I find that p of z is approximately equal, let's see, from the definition, this is the definition, there is a divergence at 0, so it's minus 1 over 2z. And then there is the term which is the resolvent at 0. The resolvent at 0, what is it? It is precisely the sum of 1 over L sum of zj. Right? This is the resolvent at 0. So there's 0, okay, there's a minus. But notice that this is nothing but the total momentum. Because if you remember, this was nothing but the momentum of the particle j, which, and this pj in the scaling limit is 1 over zj with 1 over L for this function. So this is the total momentum of my state. But because I have cyclicity, because I'm considering a closed trace, the total momentum should be an integer. Because I have cyclicity of the trace. And so that should be here plus some g of 0. It should impose that it is equal to some by m. And this is cyclicity of the trace. And then there is the derivative, g prime of 0, which is minus 1 over zj square sum with 1 over L. And this, the relation to the energy was that the energy was equal to minus 2g square g prime of 0 over L. I think I forgot this over L in the last lecture. So here there is plus g prime of 0 times z plus dot dot. So the idea is that from this point here, if I find P, I can read the energy of my state. Okay? What else do I should I impose on my p? What other analytic properties should I impose on my p of x? Well, we can also study this function, this analytic function p of x, close to z equal infinity. How does this function behave close to z equal infinity? Each summand becomes just 1 over z, so p of z behaves like m over l minus 1 half. This is the residue at infinity times 1 over z plus. This is another thing I need to impose. And for us, this is enough. Okay? Any question about this? Something else that I could do, instead of computing the average around the curve, I could compute the discontinuity in the curve. And we saw that the discontinuity, so delta p over, as someone pointed out, there was a sign wrong, over minus 2 pi I, again, by using this identity, 1 over x plus I0 was principal power plus minus delta function, now the delta function survived, so this was precisely the density of the function. But sometimes I don't need the density because I just want the energy of my state. Okay, so is there any doubt concerning this construction? I will now show how to apply it in practice for the simplest case where we have, for example, one single line instead of many lines. Maybe you can, yeah?
For p close to z equals infinity, p is supposed to diverge or it's supposed to be small like this?
No, it's 1 over z. Supposed to be very small because each term here goes to 0. 1 over z goes to 0, 1 over z goes to 0. So p goes to 0.
Okay.
There is 1 over z here. Right? The coefficient is constrained to be this. Okay, so let's study then what are called one-cut solutions. One-cut solutions because I want to consider the situation where I have one cut in the complex plane with some mode, which is associated with some mode number. Okay, so I want to find my function p of x, p of z, which has one cut in the in the complex plane. Let's try to write down p of z. You will rederive this result for a single cut in two different ways in today's tutorial. But let's guess that will be in a third way. So what should p of z be? What functions do you know which have a cut? What's the function that you know that has a cut?
Square root.
Square root. Okay, so there will be a square root. Now, I want a single cut. So how many branch points do I want? Two. So let me parameterize the two branch points. Let me think, for example, a, z plus b square plus c, z. This is a way to parameterize the quadratic function inside the square root, right? Now, this function should go to zero at can behave singularly at 1 over z, so I can also have some 1 over 2z multiplying the square root. And a priori, there could be a constant term d. So let's write this ansatz, and let's convince ourselves that this is indeed the good ansatz and the most general one that we could have written. Okay, so let's start imposing the several boxes. Do you have some preference for where to start? Maybe this one. The average of the function at the two sides of the cut should be 2 pi n. So what is the average of this function on two sides of the cut? What happens when I take the average of this function on the two sides of the cut? No? I have a square root here, with a cut here. I am on top, slightly above the square root, I get some value. What happens when I go around and go slightly below the square root? What's the difference? Sorry? You get?
Minus.
You get a minus, right? So when I evaluate the function here, I have something like square root. When I evaluate it here, I get the opposite sign for the square root. That was the square root name. So what is the average of the function along those 2 points? Almost. That term here gives, this term here gives how much?
Zero.
I just computed above, I get plus square root, below I get minus square root. So p slash on the cut is equal to 2d. Okay, so d is equal, let's define, I prefer, with a minus sign, because I want to put the cut on the right, so let's put a minus sign. It's just a redefinition. So d is minus pi n. Okay, so we fixed one of the constants. Okay, good. Now, let's do, for example, this one here. So this was using 1. Let's use 2. Close to z equal to 0, it should behave like minus 1 over 2z, which I already wrote here. So what? Which constant does it fix now? When I impose that this leading term, it should behave like minus 1 over 2z. So let's put z equal to 0 inside the square root. This term disappears. So b should be equal to?
1.
So okay, so 2 fixes b equal to 1. When I impose that p, b is like minus 1 over 2z. Okay? Furthermore, let's see which one is simpler. Okay, let's, instead of using the rest of 2, we still have some terms to use of 2, but let's now use the third box, because the leading coefficients are always easier. And let's impose that p, so we have now also this one, that p was behaving like at infinity, like L over m minus a half times 1 over z. Now, let's take z going to infinity. First of all, it doesn't even seem to go to like 1 over z. When z is very large, a z squared dominates, so I get a constant here and a constant here. So this immediately tells me that a must cancel this z. Otherwise, it doesn't even decay at infinity. Right? So the first thing is that a is equal to 2 pi n. Otherwise, there is a constant at infinity. We want 1 over z. We don't want a constant. And then, when we compute the subleading term, when we check, when we impose that it decays in that way, we find that c is equal to 8 pi n m over l. The m appears there. Okay, so we fixed all the functions. We fixed all the these constants. Okay? So you can compute the branch, the position of the branch points and see where they are, and you will do it in the exercise. And you could even draw the cut if you want. Okay. And now, we can just compute the energy of this state by expanding p at 0. So the energy of this state, which has many particles here, which a priori it will be very complicated to solve this equation, is just obtained by continuing to expand at 0, we know all the constants, and picking the linear term. And the result that we find is that the energy is equal to, I think I know by heart, so it's 8 g squared m l minus m pi squared over l cubed. Okay, so this is the result. You remember that I told that the energy was going like 1 over L. This indeed goes like 1 over L. Here there is L squared. Here there is L cubed. And this is the value of the energy of a single cut solution, of a classical single cut solution, which has m particles. So m particles. And the length of the spin chain, the length is L. So I'm studying operators of the form trace with many z's, many x's, where all this number of x's, which is equal to m, goes to infinity, and the number of fields, this L, also goes to infinity. Very long operators, which are classic, which correspond to some classical limit of the spin chain. Okay, very good. This was faster than I thought. Very good. Any questions? Is it clear now? So you see that now if you wanted more complicated functions, you could also try to do it. It would not just be square roots, it would be more complicated. There are fancier methods to do it, but I think this example is illustrative of the kind of techniques, and in the exercise you will see other techniques to solving this single cut solution. Okay? Yeah, the way it's done in the exercise, it's an easier way than the one we did it here. But I mean, makes sense to do the harder one here. Okay. There are no questions? Let's move on. Okay. So, the idea now, we will make quite a jump and go to the other side of the correspondence. Let's study strings moving in S3. So S3 is a subspace. S3 is a subspace of DDS5, and we want to consider strings in this S3, which is contained in DDS5. And the motivation to considering strings in S3 is that in the same way that we consider the subset of operators, which was just these X's and Z's, I said that any operator corresponds to a single string state, and the anomalous dimension of that operator was the energy of that single string. So when I consider only a subset of operators, I'm considering only a subset of classical solutions, of a subset of strings on the dual model. And that it turns out that a subset of strings which are dual to the operators which we are considering all the time, this X and Z, this SU2 sector, are strings which move only in S3, which only move in the sphere inside the DSP. Okay. So, what is the Lagrangian for strings moving in S3? So, okay, let me mention why. A bit more motivation, so let me mention some more motivation. So we consider now a classical image. Our idea is, can we now recognize some of the results that we have seen in this classical image of spin chains by considering the classical image of string theory? Of course, a priori, we should not be too optimistic because it is still weak coupling versus strong coupling. We are at weak coupling when we are doing HTV computations. We are at strong coupling when we are doing string computations, like John emphasized. So a priori, we have no reason to be very optimistic. But at least we are comparing classical quantities in both sides. So this might be we might be more optimistic to success, and we will succeed. Okay, so the Lagrangian, there is an integral over sigma and tau, right? So there is the coordinate sigma of the string, and then it evolves in time. And then, let's always do Polyakov. There is some d mu n dot d mu n. So this will be just a free bosonic string with n being the position of the string, right? So I have a vector n pointing, and there is this. This is just a Polyakov action that we have seen several times during Freddy's lectures and more, right? Do you recognize this? Now, we don't want this. We want the string to be obliged to live in the sphere. We don't want a free string moving wherever she wants. We want her to always stay in the sphere. So what can we do to impose that this vector n stays in the sphere?
N squared equals 1?
Yeah.
So we could subtract the constant times n squared minus 1?
Not a constant. A field. Lambda. This is a field, so lambda of sigma and tau, because for each point of the string is in the sphere. Okay. So, but you're right, we have to put a Lagrangian multiplier times the constraint n squared minus 1 Lagrangian. Right? This is the Lagrangian multiplier, it's like a delta function. A delta function is the integral of e to the ixp. But now for each point in space in the world sheet of the string, I need to impose the constraint. So I need to put one field for each sigma and tau. Okay, this is also a field. I also integrate over this lambda in the past. Okay. So this is a strongly interacting field theory. It is not of the sort that you are used to seeing throughout the course, where you have some free field, and then you have small expansion, small parameter, where the equations are something like box phi plus lambda phi square, and lambda is a small parameter, and you can expand it. So for example, imagine you want to compute the equations of motion for this field. Can someone tell me the equations of motion?
It's a calculation.
No, but it's more or less trivial. Derivative with respect to the derivative of n gives the derivative of n. And then I take the derivative of that. Okay, so d square of n. And then there is the derivative of n. Right, so plus lambda times n. These are the equations of motion. But what is lambda? Lambda is a field. What is this field lambda? Let's, for example, take the inner product of this equation with n. By taking the product of this equation with n, I get that n inner product of d squared n plus lambda equals to 0. Why didn't I put anything here? Because n squared is equal to 1. And this term here is equal to minus vn squared. Why?
That's the boundary term, right?
No, not for the boundary term, because since n squared is equal to 1, when I take the derivative, I get that vn dot n is equal to 0 of this relation, and now I can take a second derivative to get that this term is equal to minus this term. Okay? And therefore, lambda is given to this, by this. So the equations of motion for a string in the sphere are second derivative of n minus dn squared times n is equal to 0. So you see very clearly that the equations of motion are some nonlinear equations. It's not like box of n plus some small correction. No, it's nonlinear. The starting point is something nonlinear, strongly coupled. And this is your starting point. You cannot just expand in Fourier modes and start creating your particles in your Fock space or whatever. So it's not a theory that you quantize in a standard, in a straightforward way. Now, but you could start solving equations of motion for these strings, and actually in tomorrow's tutorial you will consider some subset of classical solutions, which are circular string solutions, and you will be plugging an ansatz for some circular strings inside these equations and checking whether you can find some classical equations of motion. But here I want an alternative representation of this more standard formalism. I want to use the fact that the sphere S3 is the SU2 manifold to introduce a group element G, which is made out of the components of this vector. And by introducing this G, I can check that the determinant of this G is equal to n squared, which we want to infer that it's equal to 1. Therefore, we want to infer that this G is an element of SU2. The action of my theory, okay, this was the action, not the Lagrange, I'm not that complex. The action is basically the integral of trace, this is something that you can check, of g squared, where g is g minus 1 dg. So if g lives in SU2, this j here lives in the algebra, which I could write with small letters if you would like. Okay, so the action of my sigma model, it turns out it can be written in this way, where the constraint that I'm integrating over fields which belong in SU2 is the same as imposing the constraint that n squared is equal to 1. So I should integrate over fields in SU2. The equations of motion which follow from this action, when I vary this g, are the following, can be written as d star j equal to 0. Is this notation familiar to everyone? So first of all, notice that this, what is this? Is this object a matrix, a vector? Is it clear that for everyone that this is a matrix? This is a... So this is, let me write, let me be maybe more specific. There is a decomponent J0, which is G minus 1 derivative with respect to tau of G, and there is a component J1, which is G minus 1 derivative with respect to sigma of G. And G is a 2x2 matrix, and this, of course, and by this notation here, I don't know if it's clear to everyone, so let me write, I mean just conservation of the current. Okay. And these are the equations of motion. Now, because the current is of this form here, there is this J is flat. So there is also, it's an identity, the flatness condition. It's not an equation, which tells me that dj plus j, where j is equal to 0, and in case this is not clear, this means that d mu j nu minus d nu j mu plus commutator of j mu j nu equal to 0. Okay. Maybe there is a sign. It's not right. Okay. So is this equation clear for everyone? Why this equation is true if I have a flat current? You see that if you have this looks like a connection of an Abelian gauge theory. And the fact that this connection is written in this way means that this connection is pure gauge. You remember that when you make a gauge transformation, the connection in an Abelian gauge theory transforms to g minus 1 ag plus g minus 1 dg. So if the connection is just this term, it means that it is a pure gauge transformation, pure gauge, the same as if it was 0. And when the connection is pure gauge, it means that F is equal to 0, the field strength is 0. Right? Because it's just pure gauge, it's not physical. And free F equal to 0 is precisely this equation here. This is just written in. So this is just because J, this is equivalent to saying that J is a pure gauge. And in the same way that you can just check, you can just compute this using the fact that A is given just, J is given just by this form, and check that it is an identity, not an equation. Okay, so this identity tells us that J is a current, and that there exists a group element G such that J is just a flat current, it's just obtained by G minus 1 dG, whereas the other equation are the equations of motion, conservation and this current G. Okay, so I have these two conditions, which describes the model classically. Now, let me encode these two conditions into a single statement, which is, according to my notes, there is a minus here. And, okay, that's it. Okay, let's construct the following object, J, a view. At some point, U will become X because in my notes it's X, but I want it to be U. So warn me when I replace U by X. Let's construct this J of U to be given by this current J plus U star J over U squared minus 1. Is it this notation clear to everyone? Again, the stars and this J. Is it? I can write in components. It's the same. J mu is equal to J mu plus U epsilon mu nu J mu over U squared minus 1. What is U? U is a complex number. It's called a spectral parameter. Exactly like we saw yesterday, or two lectures ago, I don't remember. When we had an auxiliary variable, which was quite important to make to ensure that the model was integrable. So let's define this current. What is special about this current? J of U is flat for any U. And let me explain why I'm putting two exclamation marks and why this is. So first of all, flatness of this current means that J dj minus J where J is equal to 0. If you would compute this, you would see that what you get is indeed something like u square minus 1 square, and then you get something like, this is completely wrong, but morally it's correct. You get u times, say, the equations of motion, for example, plus the flatness condition. So this is equation 1, this is equation 2. You get 1 and 2. And because this, I'm saying that I want to impose that this is 0 for any u, both this coefficient and this coefficient must be 0, and therefore flatness of a single current imply at the same time the two equations that I want to impose for my physical fields of my sigma model. Okay, you can do this exercise, very simple. I don't know if you get u, u squared, whatever. You get two different functions of u, which therefore must, the coefficient must be 0. Okay. Why is it so interesting to have a flat current in a two-dimensional field theory? Because with this flat current, I can construct an object which I am going to call L of U, And the fact that I'm using the same notation is because the objects are really the analog of one another. So this will be the analog of the monodromy that we had introduced. And this L of U, you remember what it was a product of R operators, an ordered product of R operators. And now here it is a Wilson loop, path ordered exponential. You saw some Wilson loops in Jamin's lecture, right? Of the integral around the path gamma of this current J of U. And what is this path? This here is the cylinder, and this path gamma is some curve which wraps the cylinder. And now, or for example, let's not consider such funny curves, let's consider it, I'm going to explain in 1 second that it's equivalent. Let's consider a simple curve, which is a curve which is characterized by tau being constant. Right, only sigma changes in this curve. Now,
question?
Yeah?
Yeah, so why is the action trace of J squared?
You can just compute J here, compute the trace, compute J squared, take the trace using these factors n, and check that you get the n squared.
It is exactly...
You don't get the Lagrange multiplier, you get just the n squared, you get just the first term.
Oh, just
because the Lagrange multiplier, in this setup, you impose by saying that you integrate over fields which belong to SU2.
Oh, SU2. Okay.
Was the question and the answer clear to everyone? There you go. Okay. So, next, and finally, let me construct the object T of U, and you see that I'm using the same letter, several letters which we already used before on purpose, which is the trace, right, of the trace of the monodromy matrix of this L of U. And now the statement is that this object is independent of where we put this contour gamma, provided it wraps the cylinder once. Can someone tell me why? Why is this object is the same independent of where I put gamma, whether I put it here or here, some other gamma prime? Why is this quantity the same for any two loops?
Because we're in flat space.
We are not in flat space. The fields, the equations of motion for the fields, are the equations of motion for the fields in a sphere, in S3. They give the equations of motion that I wrote here. When you have a Wilson loop, and you change a bit the contour of the Wilson loop, what is the variation of the result? What is the variation proportional to? No one told you? No? Were you told?
No.
No? Okay. So the idea is that when you have a Wilson loop and you make a small variation, which is parameterized by some element with S mu nu, which are like the area element of this change, the change in this Wilson loop is proportional to this area, S mu nu, contracted with a field strength, F mu nu. And F mu nu here is zero because the current is flat. It means that you can deform the Wilson loop. Okay, so, and this means that you can put it here or here at any point and you get the same. Okay, so that's interesting. So let's construct this, let's write T of U as 2 cosine of P of U. And again, I'm using P, which will be the analog of the P that we used in the gauge theory. What is the meaning of P in this way? E to the I P of U, or E to the plus minus I P of U, are the 2 eigenvalues of L of U. L of u has two eigenvalues, and it's e to the ip, e to the minus ip, the sum of both is twice cosine. Why one is lambda and the other one over lambda? Because it's an SU2L. So the determinant is one. The eigenvalues should be with the inverse of one another. So I parameterize them by this p. Okay. Now,
sorry, what do these cylinder diagrams represent? I thought we were on the surface of a sphere.
So, very sorry that I didn't say so. You have sigma running here, tau running here, and for each point in the world sheet, which is a cylinder, right, we have sigma and tau, we map it to a point in the sphere of the string. And another point here, you map to another point of the string at the same time. And when you move in time, you are pointing to a point of the string at some other time. It's the usual map. At each point of the world sheet, sigma and tau is mapped to a field N of sigma and tau. Okay? Very good. Okay, so these are the two eigenvalues. And now, again, okay, so first, before that, this, let's explain why did we put here these two exclamation marks. Because it's independent of the path. This means that T of u for some constant path tau is equal to T of u for another path tau prime. This means that we have a quantity which depends on the field. For each solution, I compute this Wilson loop. Right? You give me a solution of the equation of motion, I compute this Wilson loop. And then I can get some quantity which is independent of the time. But this is a conserved charge. This is what a conserved charge is. It's something which depends on the fields of the world sheet and which is independent of where I put it in time. So this is a conserved charge, which implies infinitely many QMs. Why? Because I can then expand in Fourier and in Taylor series, and for each coefficient of u, I get a conserved charge. Exactly like in the spin chain. In the spin chain, we had that the t commuted with h. Now the statement is that I can put this loop wherever I want in any possible time. Does it answer your question?
Well, we said that j is flat for any u, so why does that mean that the trace is constant?
Because the fact that j is flat means that I can put the contour wherever I want. It is still a function of u. It's not a function of tau. A priori, you would say, okay, t of u is a function of the path. So it's a function of u and the path. You could think, is it a function? And the answer is no. It doesn't depend on where I put it. It is just a function of u. So it's a conserved charge. You give me a classical solution, I give you a conserved charge which depends on u, and therefore I give you an infinite set of conserved charges. And therefore, the model is integrable. So this is what gives me integrability. It's existence of many, many conserved charges in the model, as we saw. Okay, so what do we know about this T of u? What can we know? What can we tell about this theory? So first of all, this here is an analytic function, except maybe at u equals plus minus 1, because there the connection has singularities, and therefore the result of the Wilson loop will have essential singularities at those points. Right, because we are integrating something which is singular at those points. But apart from 1 and minus 1, this is an analytic function. So let's take the derivative of this relation to notice that p prime, okay, twice p prime sine of p is equal to p prime of u, and therefore p prime is equal to p prime of u over square root of p of u squared minus 4. Hope I didn't do any mistake. Let me see. Probably I did. Yeah, I did. There is a minus here and a plus. Is this clear? I just wrote the sine as square root of 1 minus cos. And therefore, we see that p prime is a function which lives in a Riemann surface. So this P prime defines a two-shaded Riemann surface. Because of this square root here. And the branch points of this Riemann surface are the points where this t is equal to plus 1 minus 2. When this t is equal to plus 1 minus 2, I get the branch point singularity for this t prime. Okay. So this means that p prime will be a function which will live on the Riemann surface. Recall that yesterday I showed you exactly the same picture. There will be some cuts, exactly like the ones we saw. And p prime here, which is p prime, right here, p prime of u minus 0, jumps smoothly when I go to the cut here to p prime minus p prime of u plus 0. What about p when we cross a cut? Notice that p is defined up to 2 pi n. So when I jump through a cut, what can happen to p is that p can jump by an integer, by a multiple of 2 pi n, and doesn't need to be continuous in the same way as the derivative does. So for p, what we find is that p of u minus 0 minus, when I jump to the other p, minus p of u plus 0, let's remove the I, can be equal to 2 pi n when I am at the cut. And this is nothing but p slash is equal to 2 pi n, the relation that we saw in the steam chain model. So we also have a function p, which we must find by solving a Riemann-Hilbert problem, which has this discontinuity, and where, when crossing a cut, it can jump by 2 pi n. What else do we know? Let's think about u going to infinity. Actually, I call it c before. U going to infinity. When u goes to infinity, this flat, this j of u becomes just j, if I recall correctly, or becomes what? Let's see. This j of u, when x goes to infinity, j of u behaves as star j over u. And therefore, this t of u behaves like 1, because when u goes to infinity, this becomes 0, so the path order just gives 1, plus 1 over u integral d sigma of j tau, by putting the components ready and considering this kind of contours. And this is nothing but a conserved, one of the conserved charges, one of the angular momenta of my sigma model. Notice that this model has symmetry when I rotate my g to the right and to the left, because the action is invariant. The action, the Lagrangian, was trace of g minus 1 dg, so it's invariant under g going to g times h, where this is a constant matrix, or h times g, where this is also a constant matrix. And these two symmetries, they are related to the rotation symmetries of the S3 model. See what it means at the level of the fields x and 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. It means precisely the rotations. So the geometrical meaning are just rotations. So it turns out that this gives some charge associated with rotations that I can parameterize as j1 plus j2. And similarly, when u approaches 0, when u goes to 0, my j of u behaves as minus j over u, and this j turns out to be the is it j over u? No, j. Then I would need to expand further. Minus u star j, and therefore by seeing what the path integral gives, and I don't want to put too much time here, you would see that t of u would behave like 1 plus u times j1 minus j2. And from here, you can understand how p behaves close to these points. And therefore, what you find is that the function p of u that you will obtain, it will obey this equation. P of u will behave as 2 pi j1 minus j2 over u when u goes to infinity. P of u will behave like 2 pi m minus 2 pi j1 plus j2 over 2 times x times u when u goes to 0. And P of u behaves like 2 pi the energy of the string over u square minus 1 when u goes to plus minus 1. So all these points, infinity, 1, minus 1, you can analyze because these are singular points where the problem simplifies and when you can therefore predict what the value of p should be. So you are left with the following problem. You must find the function p of u which solves this Riemann-Hilbert problem here with this kind of analytic asymptotic behavior. Okay? And again, the asymptotic behavior just follows because at some particular points you can predict exactly because the slack connection simplifies and the current becomes just the current associated with some of the symmetries like rotations or whatever. So the end result is the following. For each classical solution, you can compute the Wilson loop and therefore compute P of x. But I'm telling you that actually you don't need to do this. Because I can make you a catalog, a list of all possible P of x's, because I know that P of x is some Riemann surface, and Riemann surfaces are uniquely identified by mathematicians. So instead of working with equations of motion, I can work with algebraic geometry, if you want, and just work with properties of Riemann surfaces. And study what are the Riemann surfaces with these properties, the way this Riemann problem and have these asymptotics. And then, by making a catalog of the Riemann surfaces and reading the energy, in this case, from this residue at plus or minus 1, I compute the classical spectrum of strings in S3. So this is a fancy way of computing energies of strings moving in S3. Instead of solving equations of motion, we make catalog of Riemann surfaces and compute the residue at those ones. If you repeat the one loop, the one cut computation that we did in Young-Mills, in this case, there is some identification, roughly speaking, J1 plus J2. Now I don't remember by heart. I don't remember by heart. But it's something like, I should have known. Let me think. J1 plus J2 is L, J1 minus J2 is N. In this dictionary. This is found just because these are charges, and I can compute charges both at weak and at strong coupling. They are quantum numbers of the states, so I can identify them on both sides. And if you do this, the energy that you find, repeating the same kind of exercise, is square root, and you will actually find this exercise from studying directly classical solutions. But here I'm telling you that it will do it from the one-cut solution. The energy is square root of j squared plus m squared. OK, and I'm missing something, sorry. OK. And this is equal, this energy is equal. If I expand at very large j, I can write that energy minus j is equal to n squared over 2j. And okay. What is this curly j? I'm sorry, I'm jumping slide. So let me just be more vigorous. I'm considering not the general one-cut solution, but I'm considering the simpler example where j1 which corresponds under this dictionary to m being L over 2. And there might be some mistakes there. But the point is that if you plug into the previous result m equal to L over 2 in the Young-Mills result, this is precisely what you find. You find precisely the same result. And I'm just doing, I could do the general one and I will ask my question. Yes?
So what is the energy square root of j squared plus m squared?
This is the, this turns out to be the output of the computation. You just do the same, repeat the same, and this is the result. I'm not telling you the details.
And j squared is like
j1? J squared is like j1 plus j2, actually. It's done more carefully in the exercise that you will do this after. There you can read. I don't know where it is. Yeah. But, okay, but how could we compare what is happening here is that what we are doing is we are considering the result where square root of lambda is very large. Remember that this is the classical string. Whenever I have the action, I should multiply the action by square root of lambda. This square root of lambda is very large. The charges are very large. J are very large because it's a classical state, so the charges must be large. But what I am doing when I am expanding in this way is that I'm considering the limit, we can consider the limit, where square root lambda over j is small. Okay? So, and this would still be a classical limit. This is in an honest string computation, I could consider this limit. And I would be perfectly within the classical string region. Right? Square root lambda is very large, j is very large, but this ratio could be small, 0.01 or whatever. And now, I could expand my result of the strong coupling computation in terms of this small parameter. So I could add that the energy of my string would be equal to a sum of some coefficients and then square root lambda over j to the n. And look at this, looks very strange, because normally what you expect, the normal, I put here normal, is that the energy from computed from the string side is equal to some sum of 1 over square root lambda, which is the coupling, to the n times some coefficient cn. We don't expect to see square root lambda upstairs. Square root lambda is large, so this is the 1 over square root lambda is the parameter of the expansion. But if you consider this double scaling limit, where square root lambda over j is small, you might re-express your string results in a sum like this. Yes?
What is lambda?
Sorry, what is lambda? Lambda is the coupling, the tooth coupling, which in the string theory is what multiplies the action with regard to the string tension and the radius of ADS. Right? So Jami identified that the tooth coupling was related to the ADS radius,
yes,
which is what multiplies the action when you fix n squared to be equal to 1, then you extract, then you put it outside.
So is it you also use the adapter for the multiplier?
Yeah, of course, it's not the same.
Sorry.
No. The square root lambda is the coupling. The string coupling is 1 over square root lambda. So lambda very large means classical strings because the action is just compute classical solutions. You write the particle that is the square root lambda multiplying the action, right? And okay, let me write here another Lagrange multiplier than n square minus 1. This lambda is the usual notation for the tooth coupling. So, okay, and by doing it in this way, we might wonder whether can we compare with gauge theory. Because gauge theory is exactly this kind of results that you get. You also get an expansion in lambda and not in 1 over square root lambda. Yes, Eric?
Yeah, sorry, so why are these expressions for the energy?
Why are, because I have some result, which depends a priori in this one, on this one. So if both this one and this one are very large, but if I arrange them in such a way that this ratio is small, I can expand my result, and I get some expansion like this.
Okay.
Because this ratio is small.
And how do you know if it's upstairs or downstairs?
No, because this is a small parameter, so I get,
small for
I get sum of x to the n. But now this looks like a weak coupling computation. This is the kind of thing that you get at weak coupling. You get lambda plus on the square plus on the cube. It doesn't look like a strong coupling computation. So you might wonder, can we compare with gauge theory? And the answer is no, a priori no, because this is an order of limit issue. You cannot pick functions and expect that this is the same as the result when you expand a small lambda and big j. It's not the same a priori. cannot pick functions and just expand them in this way. A priori, no. So can we compare a priori? No, but it works. It worked up to two loops, up to three loops, or up to two or three loops. And actually, even though any mathematician will tell you this is crazy, you cannot do it, it was very important in the very beginning to start comparing results of strong coupling and weak coupling. Because people started computing, like I explained very roughly here, but you will see in more detail in the exercise, and they started getting some gauge, some string theory results, expanding them in this funny limit, which amounts to doing this, and taking these kind of terms, and comparing with the gauge theory, with the annual result, and getting a perfect match. And this was a very good indication. At least they had a regime, which was this classical regime, where they could compare both results by engineering this so-called Frolov cycling limit. But there is no reason for this work. And actually now we know of more gauge gravity dualities, where if you try to do this trick, it just doesn't work. But apparently in ABS-5-CFT4, in the ABS-CFT duality that I'm describing, it seems to work, and therefore it's quite useful. And it works not only for spectrum quantities like the one we are describing, but for more quantities. So whenever someone wants to study a new quantity, you can always try to study this limit, because for some reason, in any cosmic triangles, it does work. So let me end with the brief physical meaning of what are these solutions? What is the physical picture for this very fancy Riemann surface description of classical strings, curves, classical string motions? So, as I said, I have a classical string, and given this classical string, some n of sigma and tau, you compute, you put them into the element g of sigma and tau. From this element g of sigma and tau, you compute this current g of sigma and tau. From this g, you compute this g, which depends on x and sigma and tau. From this, you compute this path order exponential of this integral of j of x. From this, you compute p of x. Therefore, what you are doing basically from this point A to this point B is given a classical solution, we are mapping it to B to a Riemann surface. So if we can make a catalog of Riemann surfaces, for each classical solution we have a Riemann surface, and this Riemann surface, which is a function of x, as we emphasized, the fact that we have a function of x which is conserved, doesn't depend on where we put this path, means that the Riemann surface encodes an infinite set of conserved charges. So if I give you a Riemann surface, I'm effectively giving you an infinite set of conserved charges. So you might even wonder, can I do the opposite? Can I start studying Riemann surface and understand? And the answer is yes, there exist methods to do. Okay? But what I want to understand is, if I look at the Riemann surface, is there an easy way to get a physical picture of what kind of solutions I'm describing when I have several cuts? So each cut, as we said, when we cross the quasi-momenta, this p of x, sorry, I never use this notation, this p of x, jumps by an integer. So each cut is parameterized by an integer, n1, n2, n3. Okay? Furthermore, and I did not tell, but you remember that in the Young-Mills problem, when you integrate, when you consider the integral around some given cut, ci of p of x, you got the number of particles in that cut I. How many particles? Because we just counted by residues. It was just a sum of poles, how many there are. Okay? Similarly here, each cut, I can parameterize it by a mode number n and by its size, which is obtained by computing this integral. This is a quantity which I can compute for each cut. In a more fancy language, this turns out to be the moduli of the Riemann surface. Okay, so I have some ki and some ni for each cut. So of course, this cut has a very small ki, it's a small cut. This one has a big ki, it's a big cut, a big integral. So what is the physical meaning of this case and this ends? This case, the meaning is that they are the analog in flat space. I would expand n as a sum with some amplitudes, which I will call ki, e to the I, okay, n kj, nj sigma plus minus tau. I will decompose in Fourier, and there will be some mod numbers and some amplitudes for each mod number. And now we have some theory which is nonlinear. So the equations of motion, they were nonlinear. I could not expand in Fourier. What we did is the analog of the Fourier decompositions for integrable nonlinear models, for models that are nonlinear and for which we don't have this trivial Fourier decomposition. So in flat space, it's trivial to get solutions, just some plane waves like that, and it's always a solution. This k are amplitudes, and I recall to you that you saw in the course of string theory, they are action variables of the theory, right? They are what become quantized, become integer, those are the action variables of the theory. And these n's are the mod numbers. So just one second. So when I see a solution like this, it corresponds, roughly speaking, to a solution where you have a string moving in S3, where three modes of the string are excited. For example, when you have a solution which has only one cut, it means that only one mode of the string is excited. What kind of string has only one mode excited? Circular strings. Circular strings are only on one mode. It's just one mode excited. And indeed, in the tutorial, we will study circular strings, and the energy and charge of those strings would be exactly the ones that you would find if you would find one cut, if you would study one cut solution. If you start having two cut and three cut solutions, you know that when you would see the solution moving in S3, it would be some solution which is some more inner structure. More modes are excited, and it's not only circular, but it has some more structure. The more cuts you have, the more complicated the solution moves. And if you have some very big cut, C1, it's almost circular, and then you can put a very small cut, it means that you have small deformations to the circular string. But the explicit solution is very complicated, because it's not just the Fourier decomposition, it's something more. So n's are the analog of mod numbers, k are the action variables of the theory, and they are the analog of the amplitudes of the Fourier mode. Okay, I will finish here. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
So why is the sum of the plane waves a solution?
Because in flat space?
Yeah.
Because in flat space, the equation is just del square n equal to 0.
Oh, okay.
Any function of sigma plus tau is a solution.
And why do we want the ki, the number of particles, to be...
it's not something that we want. I am telling you what is the meaning of this. The meaning is such that if you consider these three cuts, it means that it's a solution where three modes are excited. So it's like three harmonics of the string are excited.
For how sort of...